Coming up on Tech Nation, it's algorithms to live by, the computer science of human decisions. We'll talk about what an algorithm is, which started well before computer science, and how human behavior and technology can inform each other. Then on Biotech Nation, it's all about Youth Rally, an annual camp for kids and teens with conditions of the bowel and bladder. We'll hear from its chair, Paul Hastings, who's also the president and CEO of Oncomed Pharmaceuticals, as well as Youth Rally's April Gimlin and Emily Mahler. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
Guess what? I'm a Pokestop. Well, I'm not exactly a Pokestop, but right next to my house is. You see, I live right next door to an historical landmark of sorts, and it's the Pokestop. And the best place to do your Pokemon Go business? On the sidewalk in front of my home. It all started on Monday, or if you're hearing this at another time, the Monday that Pokemon Go became available, and a gazillion people downloaded it for free to their smartphones. I was aware of this phenomenon, as it's been all over the media, but I didn't know that I'd have my own experience without ever downloading the game. Monday was a busy day for me. I made 3 or 4 different trips, as there's a newborn in the family and lots of stuff to get done. On the first trip, I came down my front stairs to get in my car parked in the driveway, and I noticed a young man glued to his phone. There's nothing there to report these days, and as the entry path to my home intersects with the sidewalk right at the entryway to the landmark's property, it's not unusual to find someone there. Yes, he was standing a few feet down my path, but that's not unusual either, especially engaged on the phone. My presence usually causes anyone standing there to get squarely back on the sidewalk, if not find another place to be. So I got in my car and checked all the rearview mirrors, and I couldn't see him, and I thought, he walked next door. Then I looked over my shoulder, and there he was, unmoved, intently working his smartphone. Wow, I thought, this must really be important. A half hour later, I drove back down the block and saw 2 young people in the same spot. Only this time, each clutched both a smartphone and a Malamute, or some similar big fluffy dog. I thought they held the leashes a little tightly for casually standing there, but then I realized they were both working their phones, just like the other guy. But with the dogs, this was a 3-handed job, and each only had 2 hands. I swung my car in the driveway and jumped out. They looked up, and I looked at them, and I said, "Pokemon Go?" They laughed and nodded. I said, "Don't quit your day jobs." They said, "We work at night." And so I've been able to view a stream of young people in their 20s, all looking prosperous, coming and standing, and when I look again, disappearing. So here's my non-scientific report of who I see. The oldest, late 20s, which syncs with the first rise of the Pokemon video game on the Game Boy when they were kids. The youngest, a lone 14-year-old, his scooter discarded on the ground beside him. No, he didn't want to talk to me, but he'd let me see his screen while he madly worked away. When I said, "I'll leave you alone now," he actually said thanks. So it clearly he's been brought up well. And that's kind of the message I've gotten throughout. They don't seem to come when it's foggy in the morning, and who knows when I'm sound asleep at night. But they're uniformly pleasant and nice, and bellwethers for a terrific generation. Perhaps the best exemplars that video games don't ruin you. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, how computer science has affirmed or confirms human behavior. Then on Biotech Nation, it's all about Youth Rally, a yearly camp for kids and teens with conditions of the bowel and bladder. Journalist Brian Christian and UC Berkeley cognitive science professor Tom Griffiths have joined forces to write Algorithms to Live By, the Computer Science of Human Decisions. I thought I would start with the first word of their title, algorithm. What's an algorithm?
Basically, just a simple series of steps for solving a problem. So we think of the word algorithm as being in the dominion of computers, but in fact, long before computers ever used algorithms, people did. And so they're everything from, you know, the way we're taught long division, you know, in grade
school.
First
do this, then do this.
Exactly.
Then do that.
To following a recipe in the kitchen, to, you know, everything going back to weaving and fine stone tools. So algorithms have been a part of human technology since at least the Stone Age.
But algorithms are just totally popular in computer science because they describe how you do things. In fact, if you study computer science, one of the books that you study or refer to is Stanford professor Don Knuth's Fundamental Algorithm. And in the preface, he quotes from McCall's cookbook.
Mm-hmm. You know, right. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, the premise of our book is that, you know, there's a class of problems that we humans face, whether it's finding an apartment or deciding where to go out to eat or dealing with our overstuffed closet. We think of these as uniquely human problems, but they're not. They correspond to a series of fundamental problems in the field of computer science. And so thinking about the optimal algorithms for solving those problems gives us a way to think in a new way and I think approach in a more productive and effective way the decisions that we make in everyday life.
Now, there's any number of pop psychology books about how do you do this or that, or the, you know, the art of tidying up, you know, does it bring you joy or not? You got science in here.
Yeah, so the key difference between our book and other books you could read about time management or home organization is that our advice is backed up by proofs.
Ooh. I like that. Time management with science.
Yeah, you don't normally think about human algorithms as being subjected to the same kind of quantitative analysis that we give to computer algorithms. And so what we do is go through and look at these parallels between human problems and the problems that computers have to solve and use that as the basis for recommending some simple algorithms that human beings can follow that are things that have been subjected to careful quantitative analysis.
I think a lot of people don't realize the relationship between humans understanding something, having an algorithm, and writing a program. And we always say, you have to understand how to do it to write this algorithm. And then whatever computer you want to write it on, you can take the algorithm and write it from there. So it goes both ways.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, certainly for any programmer, the first draft of, you know, a program or an algorithm is just the process of asking yourself, how would I solve this problem if it were me in the shoes of the computer? And so what I think is so interesting is that, you know, the field has now matured so much over the last 50, 60 years that we've begun through this process of asking ourselves, how do we solve problems? But over the last 50, 60 years, we've developed now results about which are the optimal strategies for dealing with these different problems. And so what Tom and I are doing is bringing this process full circle and saying, okay, let's kind of complete the feedback loop and say, how can we then bring the insights that computer scientists have found about which strategies are better than which and integrate that into how we approach these problems ourselves?
Well, we already dropped the dime on Marie Kondo's book, The Art of Tidying Up, and whatever brings you joy, you know, stage and get rid of the rest. What did you guys do?
So the problem that we talk about as being analogous to the problem of what you're going to do in terms of organizing your closet is a problem that computer scientists call caching. So
that's
when you
C-A-C-H-I-N-G. Caching.
Exactly right. So when you build a computer, what you do is often you have to make some trade-offs. So, for example, there are different kinds of memory that you can buy. Some memory is fast but expensive, and so you get a little bit of that. And other memory is, you know, slow but cheaper, and so you get a lot of that. An example that people might be familiar with is if you go and buy a laptop, you have to make a choice between getting a flash drive, which is fast but expensive, and a hard disk, which is slower but cheaper. And so in your computer, there's a little bit of that flash memory and there's a hard disk. And in order to be as efficient as possible, the computer keeps some of the information which it's going to need to access in the flash memory, and it keeps the rest of it on the hard disk. And so the problem it has to do is basically decide what it's going to keep in its accessible location, like your closet, and what it's going to keep in its less accessible location, like your storage container or your basement or this other place. And it does that using some simple algorithms.
Oh, my God. How does this relate to my closet?
Well, so if you're having to make a decision about...
you actually haven't seen my closet, but okay.
All right. Well, based on your description, I'm assuming that one of the problems that you face is a problem of perhaps having to get rid of some things. And so the problem that corresponds to is the one that's called cache eviction. So you need to follow a cache eviction algorithm, which is basically making a decision about what you're going to remove from your cache, right, your closet. So in the 1960s, a computer scientist called Les Bilardi investigated what the best cache eviction algorithms are. And he tried looking at random eviction. He tried looking at first in, first out, where the thing that you got first is the first thing you get rid of. Or perhaps, you know, the thing that you've had the longest in this case. And also what's called the least recently used principle, which is that the thing that you get rid of is the thing that you touched the furthest in the past. And it turns out that the least recently used principle is the winner. It's the one that works best in terms of managing the memory of computers. And the reason is that when computers use information, they're more likely to use a piece of information within a short period of time. So they're likely to use it again just after a little bit of time has elapsed. So the best predictor of whether a piece of information is likely to be needed in the future, which is what you need to know in terms of managing your cache, is how recently you used it in the past.
And so all clothes being equal, I have to say you two are guys dressed very normally. So this is, we have some female, you know, adaptations here. All clothes being equal, if you haven't worn it a long time, get rid of it.
That's the advice the computer scientists provide.
That's it. So, you know, the Marie Kondo books are flying off the shelf right now. So I don't know how to tell you this. It's like, how often do I wear that ball gown?
Yeah. Know? Yeah. I mean, the least recently used principle may not have quite the ring of an algorithm based on joy, but it does have some optimality guarantees that joy alone can't offer. So one of the great results in this field is that the ideal best way to structure your cache or your closet is with what's called clairvoyance. So if you could literally see into the future and know which objects you were going to want, then of course you just put them in the closet. But for those of us who lack the ability to see into the future, it turns out that the algorithm Tom mentioned, the least recently used principle, has this really lovely guarantee, which is that you will spend no more than twice as much time looking for the things that you want if you're following the least recently used principle than if you had been able to successfully see the future. And that is a guarantee that no other algorithm can offer.
Now, I think this works really well with papers on your desk. I mean, that was a real breakthrough for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. So in the book, we tell the story of the Japanese economist Yukio Noguchi, who he's a tax economist, and he was finding himself just absolutely overwhelmed with the amount of paperwork that was coming into his office, to the point where he was spending the better part of his week just filing it all and organizing it all. And so out of, you know, basically sheer desperation, he comes up with this strategy, which is, I'm going to put all of my papers in just one giant box. I'm not going to organize them based on the content of the, you know, information. I'm just going to, every time a new piece of paper comes in, just stick it on the left-hand side of this box and push everything over. And when I go fishing through this box to find something that I need, I'm not going to put it back where I found it. I'm just going to put it back at the left-hand side of the box.
Boy, he was really pissed off.
And so, you know, this is a strategy that he adopts, you know, almost out of desperation as a way of saying, like, I can't deal with getting organized, quote unquote. But what he found, to his surprise, was that it was not only easy, but it was surprisingly efficient. And what I think is so fascinating is that he was basically independently discovering this principle that was simultaneously emerging in computer science. There is a field of research within caching called self-organizing lists, and it's basically exactly the structure that Noguchi was using. It's, you have this giant array of items, and you're searching from them from the beginning through the end kind of linearly, and after you access something, you have this choice of where it goes back. And it turns out that an algorithm that's called move to front, which is exactly what Noguchi was doing, gives the best performance guarantee regardless of how you're using this information. So we describe in the book that, you know, the Noguchi filing system, which has this wonderful optimality guarantee on it, if you just think of this long box of papers and you literally turn it on its side, you've got a pile. And so, you know, when you're done with a paper, you just stick it on the top of the pile. When you rifle through it and find something, you don't put it back where you found it. You just put it back on the top of the pile. And this gives us a way of totally reevaluating, you know, that messy stack of papers on our desk where we think to ourselves, you know, oh my gosh, I should really get organized. In fact, you are organized, and this is the optimal structure for storing that information. I think that's a really lovely and surprising result.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guests today are Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths. You may know Brian as the author of The Most Human Human, and his writing has appeared in The New Yorker and The Wall Street Journal. Tom Griffiths is a professor of psychology and cognitive science at UC Berkeley, where he directs the Computational Cognitive Science Lab. Together, they've written Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. Now let's talk about A-B testing and how that worked really well for Obama.
Yeah. So one of the real techniques that underpins a lot of internet commerce, whether it's Amazon, Google, or the political campaigns, you know, in a presidential race, is this idea of what's called A-B testing. And the basic idea behind this is that for a given element on your web page, let's say the bright red donate button, right, on a campaign, there's any number of different images that you could show next to it, or you could change the color of the button. Maybe a bright blue is better. And you can think about the copy on the button itself, maybe contribute versus donate, or please donate versus donate. And so what web companies will do is they will test different variations, you know, so different visitors to the site. Well, some people will see a blue button that says contribute. Some people will see a red button that says donate. And they will track which variation of the site performs the best at, you know, bringing in the donation money. And this was first used at a national scale in Obama's first campaign in 2008. And it, at the time, it was basically this secret weapon. It ended up bringing in $57 million of additional campaign money just through these subtle and experimental tweaks. And now, at this point, here we are 8 years later, and it is basically considered, you know, essential, standard operating procedure for any serious web enterprise. You know, this is
make it look a little different and then see what works.
Exactly.
But this is a principle that's not just relevant to technology companies. It's something that's equally relevant in our own lives. So you might not have to choose between what web pages to show to people, but you do have to make choices between things like, say, what restaurants you want to go to. And you face a very analogous kind of problem. So the problem in choosing what website to show people is you might know one website, you know, is pretty good in terms of soliciting donations, but you can't just stick using that one because if you do, you might never discover that there's another configuration which is even better. And so this is an example of what computer scientists call the explore-exploit trade-off, where you have to make a decision about whether you're going to explore gather some more information about what things might be good, or exploit, use the information that you've got so far and sort of, you know, make as much money as you can.
I was pretty fascinated with the idea of jail time, that the amount of jail time applied actually had application in performance, shall we say, behavioral performance.
So this is an idea which shows up in the context of networking, where when you're trying to figure out how to build a networking system, one of the problems that you run into is when multiple people are trying to make a connection at once, you need to have some way of resolving those conflicts. And so one of the mechanisms that's been developed by networking, you know, computer scientists is to use a method called exponential backoff. So basically, you know, if there's a collision, you get a busy signal, what you do is you're going to go back, but you're going to go back at an ever-decreasing rate. So you go back, you know, 1 second later, and then 2 seconds later, and then 4 seconds later, and then 8 seconds later, and so on. So that you're gathering information about whether that channel is working or not, but you're not sort of, you know, using all of your resources to do it. And so there's an interesting suggestion that we talk about in the book, which is the idea that exponential backoff might also be useful in certain domains of human affairs. So the idea that, say, if you've got a flaky friend who you don't want to quite give up on, but you're not sure you want to keep investing the same level of effort trying to coordinate, you know, events that you'll go to together or things like that, you can just exponentially back them off. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you try setting up something with them and then that doesn't work. Maybe a month later you try again, then 2 months later, and then 4 months later, and so on. And in fact, the same kind of principle or one similar to it is being used in the context of setting criminal sentences in Hawaii. So this is a program where I think we're all familiar with the three strikes kind of strategies where, you know, you get very light punishment for a first or a second offense, but then, you know, the hammer comes down.
Three strikes, you're out.
And that isn't necessarily a great way of establishing a disincentive to offenders. And so there's been another strategy, which is kind of an exponential increase strategy where you maybe go to jail for 1 day for your first offense and then 2 days for your second. And then quickly this ramps up and, you know, you're starting to look at a very serious sentence after a couple of those offenses.
No matter what you do, because you've got increasing consequences to whatever you're doing, separate from the actual seriousness of the crime.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think both in the criminal justice system and in our own human affairs, we instinctively, as Tom says, have this kind of three strike and you're out mentality, which is there is some quantity of offenses that we will just forgive and ignore. And then after that point, we will just decide to, you know, permanently give up on this person or put this person in jail for, you know, some extended period of time. And the field of networking offers us a way out of this binary thinking between do I just forgive it and let it slide or do I drop the hammer? Well, in networking, the answer is that you don't need to make that choice because you immediately start imposing punishments, but they're very small. And they start increasing after that. And so this gives us a way, you know, of it's possible to show infinite, you know, mercy without requiring infinite patience. That you can always give someone another chance, but when you give them that chance can be exponentially increasing. And so it's an appropriate way of dealing with that situation.
Well, I've always understood the three strikes you're out principle. It's a question of society needs to be protected. This person isn't getting the picture. You know, and hoping that the onerous consequence of the third strike will keep people from behaving badly. But, you know, as a long-term parent, you know, I always remember here's the consequences, you know, and especially when they get to 8, 10, 12 years old, here's the consequences, and like, oh, I don't want that, I don't want that. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're growing up, you know, so months go by and you have stale consequences. They're like, Oh, yeah, I'm prepared to have that consequence. Yeah, that's easy. I'll stay in all weekend, the next weekend, but this weekend I get to do this. Yeah, cool. I'll be tired. You know, it's no problem. And it's like, so the idea of increasing, having the sort of sideline of no matter what we're doing, it's going to be increasing. There are some advantages there in behavioral modification.
Yeah, and empirically, so the pilot program for this has started in Honolulu, Hawaii, and it's called HOPE. And empirically, the results seem to suggest that running, in this case, community supervision and probation for drug offenders, both reduces the total amount of jail time served and reduces the recidivism rate. And so a number of other states have begun looking to this as a model for how to run their own programs as well, which is very encouraging.
Well, this has all been pretty logical and analytical. What about emotions? Can they be factored into the algorithms of decision-making?
Yeah. So we talk about emotion in a couple of places in the book, but one of the most prominent places in the context of game theory. So game theory is what you end up with as the mathematics for describing how to make decisions in contexts where you're not just making decisions in a static world, but making decisions that involve interacting with other people. And one of the canonical kind of insights about game theory is that these are hard decisions to make. Often they're both sort of difficult to find good strategies for, but they're also computationally hard. They require us to kind of think about what other people are thinking and, you know, so on and so on and so on. And that's something which is, you know, very computationally demanding. So one strategy that game theorists have developed for dealing with these problems is to think about how they can change the structure of games to make them easier to solve and also to yield better solutions. This is a field that's called mechanism design, or sometimes called reverse game theory. And so the idea is you say, well, here's this problem. Here's a game that, you know, we imagine people being faced with. How do we change the structure of that problem to make it into something that's easier for people to solve? And in fact, some economists and anthropologists have suggested that emotion plays a very similar role, that what it does is change the options that we have or change the value of those options in such a way that the problems that we have to solve are easier for us to solve. They turn into easier decisions and things that are better off, you know, that everyone is better off for.
I'm speaking with Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths, the authors of Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, it's all about Youth Rally, an annual camp for kids and teens with conditions of the bowel and bladder. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths, the authors of Algorithms to Live By, the Computer Science of Human Decisions.
How do we change the structure of that problem to make it into something that's easier for people to solve? And in fact, some economists and anthropologists have suggested that emotion plays a very similar role. That what it does is change the options that we have or change the value of those options in such a way that the problems that we have to solve are easier for us to solve. They turn into easier decisions and things that are better off, you know, that everyone is better off for. So one of the dangers of getting into a relationship is that the person who you're having the relationship with, perhaps particularly if they're an economist, might be looking for a better deal, right? So, you know, as soon as a better deal comes along, then they're going to go out and, you know, leave you.
You're a victim of optimal stopping. All right.
That's right. So one way to get around that is if your partner has a delusion that, you know, your value is far greater than it actually is, right? Which is essentially what love is, that they've fallen in love with you and as a consequence place inordinate value on continuing that relationship. So it changes the structure of the problem into one where, you know, now potentially things are going to work out better for everyone.
You know, when I was young, I used to always get this advice, like, write down the pros and the cons. There's some problems in that, the checklist of pros and cons.
Yeah, the formulating of an exhaustive list of all the reasons to do something and all the reasons not to do it is the kind of thing that seems like the quote-unquote rational way to approach a decision. And we talk about the origin of the pro and con list as a recommendation that came from Benjamin Franklin. He talked about it as what he called moral or prudential algebra, which we think of as kind of a forerunner to thinking algorithmically about decision making. But in fact, one of the critical insights that comes out of computer science, specifically this field that's called machine learning, is that in fact, considering more factors does not always make a better decision, and in fact, it often results in a worse decision. As a counterpoint to that, we have Charles Darwin, who was making his mind up about whether he should propose to Emma Wedgwood, and he has this diary entry where he writes a heading at the top of the page, you know, this is the question, marry or not marry? And he divides these columns and he starts talking about, you know, well, I would have constant companionship and children. On the other hand, I'd have less money to spend on books. And he iterates these things in a way that seems like he's following the Franklin principle. But in fact, as soon as he gets to the bottom of the page, he says, okay, marry, 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 QED. That's enough. I've made my mind up. He allocated this kind of arbitrary constraint of, I'm just going to think my way to the bottom of the page, and then I'm going to stop. In fact, there is an algorithm in machine learning called early stopping that is designed specifically to avoid the problems that can come from factoring in so much information that you make the decision based on irrelevant factors.
Don't overthink it.
Exactly. And exactly. That's not a message that we might expect to get from the field of computer science. But in fact, it gives us, I think, one of our best articulations of why not to overthink it.
Well, Brian and Tom, I think you've made computer science relevant to the whole world. They finally get it. So you're the messengers here. And I do want you to come back and see us.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure.
Great.
My guests today are Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths. The book is Algorithms to Live By, the Computer Science of Human Decisions. It's published by Henry Holt. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, it's all about Youth Rally, a yearly camp for kids and teens with conditions of the bowel and bladder. My guests are Paul Hastings, the president and CEO of Oncomed Pharmaceuticals and the chairman of the board of Youth Rally, April Gillum, the vice president and program co-chair, and Emily Maller, the vice president for public relations. Now, Paul, we've talked many times in the past about Oncomed Pharmaceuticals and about patient-centric drug development, and we never once mentioned that you're the chairman of the board of Youth Rally and that you have Crohn's disease. Tell us about your experience with Crohn's.
I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease at the age of 13, 1973 to be exact, and had a total colectomy or the removal of my colon in 1979 in my second year of college at the University of Rhode Island College of Pharmacy. And then part of my small intestine was removed a year later while attending the same university. So I've got 30 years of experience having gone through the perils of Crohn's disease before there were really therapies for this disease, and having gone through surgery that has enabled my life and my livelihood and my success and allowed me to volunteer with these guys at a summer camp for kids that have now 53 or 4 of these conditions that are associated with the bowel and bladder, so that they can all come and be together 1 week a summer with people just like themselves and not feel alone.
Well, let's be clear. You didn't at 19 suddenly get a call from your doctor saying, everything's going swell, let's do a surgery. You had a lot of suffering for many years, right?
Did, yes, yes. Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, other diseases of the bowel and bladder are not necessarily visible diseases, but they're incredibly painful diseases for people, both physically and emotionally. And yes, I suffered a number of years with the symptoms.
And in that situation, as a young man growing up, I would imagine it would be difficult to talk to other people. It would change what you would want to do or could do. Is that true?
It was difficult to talk to my family. It was easier to talk to other people, which is where I started learning how to talk to other people. And yes, but for most people who are not outgoing type A personalities, this is not an easy thing to deal with and to share with your friends. And this is one of the things we teach and encourage at our camp, which is to own your own body and decide when you want to talk about it, what you want to talk about and who you want to talk about it with, it because it's your body.
It's not necessarily isolating, but you have choice.
You have a choice.
You have a choice. Now, let me go to you, Emily. You have a condition in this, the list of 54?
Yes. So my story is actually very similar to Paul's. I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease at age 10 and was somewhat managed medically for a number of years before it became time to have surgery. And over the course of 2 years, I had 5 different surgeries that eventually left me also without my large intestine and missing a portion of my small on top of that. So I do have an ileostomy as well. And, you know, for many people, that type of surgery is scary and frightening and, you know, your life is over and how will you continue on? But for me, it gave me a life. You know, I knew that I was going to leave that hospital feeling better, and I did. And because of that, now I can leave the house. I can, you know, ride a bike. I can do all the things that I never got to because I was living in pain, you know, in the fetal position, you know, never able to be too far away without knowing where the closest bathroom was.
Where is everything?
Right.
And it better be close.
Yes.
Now, April, you are a mother of someone with this condition.
Right.
Tell us your experience.
Right. Well, my second daughter was born with a very rare birth defect called cloacal extrophy, which had to do with both her bowel and her bladder. At the time, we were living in Hawaii, and it was very isolated. And I found out about the organization that ran the camp before us, and I made a connection with them and got involved with them. However, with this organization, it was all, you know, older people who had colostomies and things, but I found out that they had this camp, but my daughter was an infant. So I found out more about the camp, and my background is in planning events at the high school level, and I thought, wow, I really want to get involved with this. So at the age of 2, I became involved. And
the age of 2 of your child.
Of my child.
You are a go-getter.
Right, right.
We want your genes.
Right, right. And so I volunteered at the camp, first as a counselor and then moving up to be the main program person. And did that until she was able to come. And then she came from the time she was 11 through 17 as a camper. And as Paul said, then during college, she was a counselor and then became one of our nurses. And before she came, I really saw the impact of what this was doing for these kids as far as teaching them independence, you know, that finding out that they're not alone. We hold it on a college campus. They're learning, you know, that they could go away to college. But once my daughter came and I saw the friendships and the camaraderie and what it did for her, it was tenfold of what I had seen before having it in my own home.
Now let's talk about the list of 54. People are listening saying, mm-hmm. myself or my family member, would they be on the list?
Right. So the Youth Rally serves all youth from ages 11 to 17, and we've made exceptions on either end depending on where their birthday lies and exactly what they have going on and where they're at in their lives. But those diagnoses are really anything affecting the bowel and bladder systems. So we have folks, like April's daughter, who were born with rare congenital birth defects. We have folks that live with these other invisible conditions like Crohn's colitis. And then we have a number of folks as well that congenital birth defects. Those have been victims of physical trauma. We have folks that have had spinal cord injury or were born with some sort of spinal cord impairment. And so it really runs the gamut. But the common thread is that affliction to the bowel or bladder systems.
Now let's talk about the camps. There is it one camp? Is it change places? What are we talking about?
It's one camp. One camp in the summer, and we have all of our staff and our kids come from all over the United States, some from Canada, some from South America. We are starting to get some now from Europe also. We do move it around. Like I said, we hold it on college campuses, so we move it year to year, so different experiences for the kids. They can experience different places, different, some campuses are urban, some are rural, different types of dorms, and
thank goodness for the Americans with Disability Act.
Yes, but, and we still have to look. It's surprising.
Still got to go in and make sure.
It's right. It's surprising.
Now, tell us some of the universities you've been at.
This year, we'll be at the University of Washington in Seattle. Last year, we were at the University of Colorado in Boulder. We use San Diego State University. We've been at Xavier University in Cincinnati.
San Jose State.
San Jose State.
If you've got a university,
UC
call
Irvine.
Up Youth Valley.
Right.
UCSD.
Right.
We've been at UCSD.
UCSD. Right. And what we look for, what we have to have, obviously, is the ADA. And we need to be near a major airport. And we need to be near a children's hospital. And we need to have fun things around for the kids to do on their free time.
Now, how long does the camp run?
6 days.
6 days. And how many campers do you now have?
We have, we're expecting around 130 this year. Our biggest problem is getting the word out, finding the kids. Many of the kids, they had their surgeries when they were very young. They may be healthy physically, but they're feeling alone. And, so they're not going to anywhere. They're not going to that doctor all the time. But we try to get the word out the best we can through conferences, nurses' conferences, mm-hmm. doctors' conferences, hospitals.
And now we're going to say this again at the end, but what is the website they can go to find out about this?
It's www.youthrally.org.
Easy to remember, youthrally.org.
Yes.
Okay, so how does one apply?
The applications are all online. We can print off paper copies and we'll send them out to those who contact and don't have access to technology to allow them to be able to go online and do that themselves. But it's a fairly lengthy application for campers because some of them have pretty extensive medical histories and we have to cover all of that. And there also is a component that the visit their provider fills out as well. There's a component for the provider, a component for the parents, and then a component for the camper themselves. And likewise online, we also have applications for our volunteers. So Youth Rally is 100% volunteer organization. We have a number of counselors that also come from all over the 50 states and abroad. All of them live with the same conditions that the campers live with. So they're not only, responsible for these kids while they're there, but they're mentors and role models and, living proof that, it can be done and nothing can get in your way.
Now, April, you were saying that your daughter went from being a camper to a counselor. What age can you become a counselor?
You graduate from the Youth Rally when you're 17, and you can apply at that point to be a counselor in training the next year. We really watched those kids the last year to see, who might be a good candidate. And then they apply and they need references and, most of them we have known. And if they are selected, they come back as a CIT the first year where they're, you know, really mentored very closely, and then a little less the next year, and then become a full counselor.
And this year there's 87 of those people.
You've got almost
April
one to
mentioned
one.
130 campers. We have 87 former campers, nurses, and volunteers.
That's
a great ratio.
Well, you know, this also speaks to, I'm a parent, I have a child with this condition. I'm not driving this child to the airport and say, see you later, see you in a week. You know, there's some real concern not only about there, but getting there and coming home for some of these children may be the first time they've ever been away from home alone.
Sure, yeah.
Right, right.
Now, how does that work?
Well, the way that works, and I'm the one that's, you know, talks new parents into it, calms their fears, try to calm their fears because of my background. But we have special permission from the TSA to go all the way up to the gate. The parent would take the child to the airport and, you know, put them on the plane. The parent sends a picture of the child. We have that picture. And we send a picture of what our T-shirt looks like. We are up at the gate waiting for them
right
to get off.
Right when they get off.
Right when they get off. And the same going home. We are at the gate with them watching that plane take off. We have a travel agent that we work with, and she tries to pair up kids if they're coming from the same, you know, from the same area, get them to meet beforehand, and
they can travel together.
They
hopefully.
Could travel together, right?
That would be great. Right. Do you have to work with the airlines to know they're coming?
We work with, well, mainly TSA. Our transportation works with TSA.
Yep. It's having that special access just to be able to get through to the gate. And there's a lot of us on site the day of pickup because the planes are coming in from everywhere. Within the same, you know, few hours of time frame. So we're speckled throughout that airport in our T-shirts there to get the kids.
And the airlines and the TSA are exceptionally cooperative with us. I mean, how could you not want to help someone that's helping a child come to summer camp for the first time? So it's really a wonderful cooperative effort to get these kids from point A to point B and back.
Exactly. Now, I've been in a lot of college dorms. You don't usually get your own room. How's that work?
So it really depends from campus to campus. You know, we have some campuses where, you know, obviously the food is a little better than others and there's more options, especially for some of our kids that have dietary
restrictions. They learn that no matter what campus it is, the food isn't that great.
Right. And, you know, there's always some cereal and pizza and french fries, which is most of what these kids want anyway. So there's the food, there's the actual living conditions, there's the bathrooms. You know, we've been at campuses where we have, you know, shared stalls and sinks and other ones. This year we're actually in a new dorm at the University of Washington where we will have, you know, two – it's a brand new dorm, two to a room, and each room has its private bathroom as well. And,
wonderful. Yeah. One of the things I've always had trouble with in these buildings is opening the door to the bathroom in both directions. They weigh a ton.
Right.
I don't know, they're sealed or whatever. You've got some real issues, I think, that you go through. When you go through for these things, you say, we really make sure that everybody can have their independence and go forward.
We have had scenarios where we've had to take doors off of hinges in order to allow room in some of the older dorms for some of our folks that utilize mobility aids and wheelchairs and to be able to make room in some of the rooms. Most of the dorms these days are, you know, a little bit better equipped ADA-wise, but we also have folks that might use special equipment at home that perhaps they didn't travel with or we weren't aware of ahead of time, so we go out and get that. You know, if we need a shower chair, a transfer chair, a handheld shower sprayer, you know, we'll go out. Most of it we know ahead of time. We can kind of gauge and be ready, but we're there
swing
ready to
action.
Go. Yep.
We're all and there's wireless. The kids want to know if there's wireless.
Yes.
Totally wireless.
Yes.
That's it. You know, what has happened over the years since both you, Emily, and you, Paul, you know, developed this condition and your daughter, April, a lot has happened in terms of treating these conditions. How would you two be treated today? How different would it be?
The treatments have come a long way, and there's still a long way to go, and they're always coming out with new things. You know, we have a lot of kids that, like April said, have had surgery at a very young age and aren't any longer sick, but still are dealing with their new way of
there are no magic
elimination.
Solutions here.
Right. Yeah. And even that technology, you know, our kids and campers and counselors both who utilize catheters. I mean, that technology is ever changing to become more convenient and more comfortable and more affordable for the patients themselves. So and then there's the medications. And, you know, we have some campers that require tube feedings or periodic IV fluids for dehydration issues and that sort of thing. And so the technology is ever evolving. And we're fortunate also to have a lot of suppliers that supply different medical equipment. So our campers and counselors both, you know, we have a fully stocked supply room where they can go in and try different some of these new technologies and these new products that are on the market. Certainly if they, you know, medications, we're not talking medications, we're talking ostomy supplies and catheters
yes.
and
yes.
that sort of thing. But
Devices.
Durable medical equipment.
Yeah.
And so they're able to go in and try different for those companies that are able to support us with in-kind donations.
Means a lot. Donations.
Yes.
I forgot to mention donations. You do accept cash, right?
Yes.
We do.
It's deductible.
Cash, checks, and credit cards.
Yeah. We have never turned away a child that wanted to come to camp for any reason. So we are most of us, Emily is a nurse. I'm in the healthcare industry. April is the mother of a child who's now a nurse and the mother-in-law of someone who runs a Tesla dealership and has been in marketing at Tesla. I mean, these people have done so well, and we all give back, and we all ruthlessly, shamelessly raise money. One of the things we're doing here at the Biotechnology Innovation Organization International Convention is we're part of the Patient Advocacy Pavilion. I'm the chair of the Patient Advocacy Committee at BIO. We just had a meeting yesterday. These guys attended it. And at that pavilion, what we're doing is we're talking to companies that make drugs. So Emily, for example, had access to TNF inhibitors at her age. I'm an old geezer, and all I had available for me was steroids, which was not a nice alternative when you have Crohn's disease. But so there are kids today who might have access to Humira, that might have access to Remicade, that might have access to some of the new immuno agents that Celgene and others are developing. And we go after those companies and say, do you want to do something for the kids that will be the future users of your technology, your drugs, your devices, catheters? They are generally exceptionally generous. We have an arrangement with Hasbro where they have children's hospitals and they work with us. We have arrangements with we've had arrangements with CVS Pharmacy. We've had arrangements with the suppliers of medical devices, Convatec, Hollister, Coloplast. You name these companies, some of the smallest catheter companies. I mean, April found a catheter company that wanted to work with us and provide catheters for some of our kids that were really convenient. And we just open our arms and they open theirs and we just work together and we get enough money to bring these kids no matter what.
For people who want to participate, are there if they are medical personnel, nurses, doctors, that type of thing, do they have to be in a particular field?
We have a number of our – probably the majority of our nurse volunteers are WCN nurses. So they're wound ostomy incontinence certified nurses. But that being said, we have a number of kids that have other needs. You know, as we've opened our doors to all these different diagnoses that, you know, WCN nurses aren't often on the floor dealing with acute dehydration needs, that sort of thing. So we have additional nursing staff that have experience in acute care and critical care, in trauma, in general medical surgical needs, and pediatrics. So there really is, you know, there is not one type of nurse that we're looking for, but just the general experience and the want to give back and to help these kids. I'm not sure if we've had physician volunteers in the past, although there has been interest recently.
We have one this year.
And additionally, we have some counselors that are in medical school that will eventually be physicians that are coming back to work with us. And again, the majority of our kids are independent, and the nurses are there really, or the medical professionals really, are there more to support and to assist as needed, and often, you know, to give reminders and to make sure they're taking their medications as time.
A state of readiness.
Sure, yes.
And preparedness. Yeah.
And to be amazed at what they see. They never leave without an absolute enlightenment of what just took place. And many come back. And they're volunteers too. Everybody is a volunteer. Everybody pays to come, actually.
I think one of the big things for me in just looking at this is the ability to change the perception of the campers about who they are, what their future could be, what their lives are now. That I can't imagine one going and not being a different person by the end of the experience.
Oh, by the end of the first day.
Yeah. Really?
Yes,
one day.
They come off. We used to have these situations where we'd watch a child for a few days sort of adapt. And we've done this for so many years now that that adaptation sometimes takes place the minute they step off the plane. And there's someone with a sign that says you are not alone, or a T-shirt that says you are not alone, or another kid standing with that counselor waiting for them. Immediate, you know, sort of wow. It takes a little longer for others, but for the most part, within the first day, we've designed programming now that usually by the end of the first day or the first hour that we're all together, there's a sense of belonging. There's a sense of acceptance. There's a sense of understanding the diverse nature of everybody around them, that not everybody's the same, that maybe I'm lucky with my diagnosis. Look at what diagnosis that person has. And it's amazing to watch. And then it goes on throughout the year on social media. We have Facebook. We have sites that we use where people communicate with each other and stay in touch, and people visit each other and just stay together and up to speed with each other all year round. So it really is – it's a one camp, once a year experience that extends 365 days through the connections people make.
And I'm so pissed off that you three can look at me. My nose is running. I'm tearing. I don't have a tissue.
We have that impact on people.
You do, and you should.
This is when we usually ask for the money, but we understand that we're a national public radio. Right, exactly. We're all in this together.
But I got this. Yeah. This we give. Yeah. Well, no, thank you so much. Please come back.
Oh, thank
See
you.
Us again. We'd love to hear next year just how this camp went and any other things that occur to you now that you've been here talking about it. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank
Mara.
You so much.
Thank you
we
so
really
much.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Paul Hastings is the president and CEO of Oncomed Pharmaceuticals and the chairman of the board of Youth Rally. April Gimlin is Youth Rally's vice president and program co-chair. And Emily Maller is the vice president for public relations. More information about the camp, volunteering, and donations is available on the web at youthrally.org. Again, youthrally.org. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.